very pleased that Jerry Gibbons could come all this way and tell us about supergravity.
Thank you. Well, I must admit from the outset that I am a user of supergravity rather than a constructor of supergravity theories. And these lectures have been designed with that in view, and I'm hoping that they'll form a prelude to those of Gary Horovitz. Recently we've learnt to extract information about string theory or M theory by looking at the classical solutions of supergravity models and their symmetries. In particular, a great deal of interest is focused on so-called BPS states, which correspond to solutions which are classically invariant under supersymmetry transformations. So I've angled the talks with a view to help you understand what it means to say that a solution is supersymmetric. I was asked about references. It's a rather diverse and diffuse subject. For those interested in its relationship to dualities, perhaps the most appropriate reference, though not easy to read, I suspect, for mathematicians, is are the lectures by West in this book on dualities and supersymmetric theories. That set of lectures are angled towards what is needed for understanding dualities and supersymmetric theories. I myself use that in part, but also a very old physics report of Peter van Nieuwenhuysen, which is to some extent out of date, but gained from the fact that the subject had not become over elaborate. On the other hand, I don't think it's easy reading again for mathematicians. The ideas that I'm about to expound are most clearly, in my view, described by Bernard DeWitt, not Bryce DeWitt, in a school proceedings called Supergravity 81. The standard, a compilation of papers in this subject, was put together by Seskin and Salam, and it's called Supergravity in Diverse Dimensions. It's two volumes, very large, published by World Scientific. And if you want to find a paper about higher dimensional supergravity or a reference to papers in the past, that's where you would look. I've also been greatly influenced by the papers of and articles by Peter van Nieuwenhuysen, not only in his physics report, but in these other two schools proceedings, which I mentioned at the bottom. However, as always, Peter is certainly not responsible for my errors, and no doubt would disagree with my viewpoint. So what I've tried to do is to make the viewpoint sufficient for my purposes. Oh, that's good news. Okay, fine. Right. So, first of all, what a supergravity theory is. The most important point is that they're generalizations of Einstein's theory of gravity. And they arrive at least in two different ways. One, nowadays, as the low energy, so-called zero slope, or alpha prime goes to zero limit, of string theories. But the other way in which they arise, and that's how they arose historically, is as gauge theories of the super Poincaré group, the group whose algebra was described yesterday by Dan Fried. And I want to focus on this aspect rather than that aspect. Now, supersymmetry is a hypothetical finite dimensional symmetry of particles which move in flat Minkowski space-time, or interacting particles. And if I need to refer to Minkowski space-time, I'll write it like this. And if I need a metric signature, it'll be the mainly plus one. So this indicates that it's an affine space equipped with a standard Minkowski metric of signature n minus 1 pluses and 1 minus. Now, if supersymmetry is observed in experiments, which we hope it will be ultimately, then we face the problem of making supersymmetry, which is a finite dimensional symmetry of flat space, or defined in flat space, in which the translations are included, as we saw yesterday, making it compatible with gravity. And making it compatible with gravity means making it local, in other words, making the transformations depend upon x. And in fact, it also means making it compatible with the diffeomorphism invariance of Einstein's theory. And it is believed that the only way you can do this is via supergravity theory. And so one can say, this is the only physics I'm going to say in these talks, that the discovery of SUSY leads to supergravity theories. Usually abbreviated SUGRAs, and since they do not appear to be quantizable, that almost certainly leads to superstrings. I think this point is worth emphasizing, if just temporarily, because a lot of people think that the sorts of things that people do in M theory and so forth have no link with reality. Well, the ultimate link is not high-energy experiments at the Planck scale. It would be the discovery of low-energy supersymmetry, because by then a chain of arguments you're led to looking at supergravity theories. Now, to understand what these words mean, it is helpful to recall some facts about gauging a symmetry. So the physical ideas, at least, behind it. And I'll come to that in a little bit, in a short while, more formally. Now, the super Poincaré group contains the Poincaré group. And so if we gauge super Poincaré, we must be gauging the Poincaré group. So that leads us to understand general relativity. So that stands for general relativity as a gauge group, as a gauge theory. Oh, Poincaré. And much of the structure of supergravity and the strange constraints and other things that are imposed in constructing these theories have their origin in precisely this point, how we gauge supergravity, and I hope to explain that mainly. It will be mainly the content of this lecture. Let me just say what I've just said in a slightly different way to make clear why if we add gravity, we have to do something non-trivial. Supersymmetry depends on certain parameters. These parameters are spinorial in nature, so they actually have constant spinners. Now, there's no invariant notion of a constant spinner on a manifold. Of course, there may exist covariant constant sections of the spin bundle. That's a very particular case. But in general, the spinner fields on the manifold necessarily depend upon X, and that includes the parameters that we're going to use to make the gauge transformations. So I'll make that remark here. But in the physics literature, at least, there is a procedure or a viewpoint on gauging symmetries, which is not very different from how mathematicians might think about it. And the ideas are partly kinematic, setting up what it means to say that you've gauged symmetries, and they're partly dynamical, finding a Lagrangian, which is invariant under these symmetries. So let's begin by the kinematic part. The kinematic part is by far the clearest, and finding a Lagrangian is by far the most complicated, and I want somehow to spend a small amount of time on the latter. Anyhow, what is meant by gauging a group for an algebra, and for the main part I should simply assume that what algebraic structures there are can be exponentiated to form a group or a supergroup, proceeds as follows. So we begin by supposing we have a theory on some manifold X with coordinates. The beginning theory might be on Minkowski's space. We'll just think about the manifold to begin with. And suppose the theory is in some sense invariant under the action of some super Lie group Big G, which we will assume finite dimensional. Then we seek a theory invariant under not just the finite group, but of course a set of space-time dependent gauge transformations, so the group G of maps from X to G, which is called the gauge group. Forgive me if this terminology is familiar, I'm not quite sure about the level of preparation that the audience has had. So bear with me if this is all rather trivial. And we're going to let, as usual, this be some Lie superalgebra. And let's define H to be the set of maps from the superalgebra. Now, for us, the most important point is that elements of H, which I shall write as epsilon of X, determine infinitesimal gauge transformations. And we largely work with infinitesimal transformations. And now we introduce Lie algebra valued one forms A of X mathematically you can think of as one form of tensor. And a curvature, F, which is CA plus the half of the bracket. So this bracket may be a graded bracket, it may have plus or minus sign. Which is a two-form of values in Lie algebra. Now, the main relation that we want that infinitesimally, so physicists write this like this, this is the action of an infinitesimal gauge transformation on the connection we thought of as a certain covariant derivative, which is just the exterior derivative plus a bracket. So dA covariant derivative. And the aim of the game is to introduce some action functional, which is an integral over x of a Lagrangian, where psi are a set of fields. And we want to introduce it such that the change in the Lagrangian under a supersymmetry transformation is the total derivative. And so, the change in the action will be some boundary term. Now, boundary terms are important, but I'm going to ignore them in what comes here, so I won't say much about them until later. Now, you've not only got to construct the Lagrangian, but if the fields are not the same as the connections. The fields might comprise the connections, but they might comprise other fields as well. Then you've got to invent an action of the group or the algebra on the fields so that this statement is true. And you've also got to show that it really is an action, which means that the commutator of two transformations is yet again a transformation. And this is a rather murky business. So one talks about the closure of the algebra. So one seeks an action on phi such that at least, now in the literature people call this on shell, which means subject to the classical field equations. Another way of saying is evaluated on the critical points of this action, such that the algebra closes, such that you can write delta epsilon 1, let's say, delta epsilon 2 minus delta epsilon 2, delta epsilon 1 on all the fields is a transformation delta epsilon 3 on the fields, where this relation is supposed to correspond to the bracket relations that you start off with. Okay, well, it doesn't really suffice. I mean, one would prefer to have a complete action. Okay, so sometimes you can augment the original fields with auxiliary fields and have a proper action. That makes life simple. Sometimes that doesn't seem to be known how to do it. But from my point of view, being on shell is adequate because it takes classical solutions to classical solutions, critical points to critical points. But in the quantum theory, I think the thing is much more murky. In principle, yes, that's right. Now, as far as I understand the subject, what people started off doing is pursuing this experimental procedure, if you like, and then finding whether or not they can. The general theory of when and not, when it's possible and when it's not, is certainly not known to me. It might well be that it isn't. But okay. Now, one point about this transformation, which will be useful later on, is that in a supersymmetric theory, typically, if these are two spinorial transformations, this is something like a diffeomorphism. So this relation actually tells you that, in some sense, you can take the square root of a vector field. And that arises in very specific situations in a nice way. So let's look at invariant configurations. They would be configurations such that, let's call them phi zero there, such that there exists some parameter, epsilon of x, such that delta of epsilon zero, phi zero is zero, which means that the covariant derivative epsilon is zero around the relevant background is equal to zero. Now, this situation is sufficiently common to give it a name. So, elements epsilon zero of H, for which this is true, are typically called, well, I'm going to coin a phrase, but they're called, as we've been coined before, killing adjoints. And the most important examples are killing vectors and killing spinners. Now that's important when things feed into geometry, because typically this equation defines a privileged spinner field on some background. For example, it may mean that the spinner field is covariant constant, or it may mean that the covariant derivative is related to some Ramon-Ramon field multiplying using Clifford algebra, the epsilon. And so this equation is one of the most important equations in the business, working out what this equation is and finding the solutions. Because solutions which admit these things will have some supersymmetry, and in the quantum theory are expected to correspond in some way to BPS states, or special states. So, as I said, there are two obvious cases, killing spinners and killing vectors. And typically, if you've got a couple of these spinners, or even if you've just got one, then you can form a killing vector out of the killing spinner, and they have some nice properties. Well, that's all a bit vague and woolly. Let's start with Einstein gravity. So that's the particular case for which the gauge group is just the Poincaré group, and we won't have any spinners to begin with. Now, you can look at Einstein gravity in many ways. The way I'm about to expound is not very popular among classical relativists, and indeed it's a bit redundant. It's not necessary. But it seems to be the way which is churned to have to think about supergravity. So G now is Poincaré acting on X, which we think of as Rn. And it's convenient to have a matrix representation of its action. And we do it as follows. It sends XA and 1, so I'm looking at it projectively, if you like, to this. Where lambda is in SO n minus 1, comma 1, of course A is in Rn. So this is a Lorentz transformation, and this is a translation, and I'm just exhibiting the semi-direct product structure of the Poincaré group, and A is, let's say, 0, 1, up to n minus 1. Of course, there are some constraints on this matrix that it be a Lorentz transformation. Now, the Lie algebra in this case is just given by infinitesimal rotations, translations, and they have traditional names. And G is the Minkowski metric, then this should be skew when you lower an index. Now, I could write that statement out in fancy language, but I hope it's clear what's going on here. QAB equals Minkowski metric. When I need it, I shall have it. Well, now, if we just follow our nose and gauge this, we'd have one forms looking like this. So this would correspond to rotations or Lorentz transformations, and this would correspond to translations. And we can now compute the curvatures using the bracket relations. And what you discover is that F can be written as RAB TA 0, 0. Well, that statement is, of course, almost true by definition. The question is, what is the R and what is T? Now, the answer to that is that RAB is d omega AB plus omega AC plus omega CB, and TA is dDA plus omega AC. Now, you notice that these look suspiciously like Cartan structural equations. So what you would like to do is to identify this as the Riemann curvature tensor, and this is the torsion of a connection on the tangent bundle of the manifold X, and such that E can be thought of as a set of orthonormal one forms. Now, that's what we'd like to do. So we want to identify this as the Levi-Civita connection on the T of X. EA as orthonormal frames. And the metric would just be JB EA tensor EB. Now, what's wrong with that is, of course, that we've just constructed, in some sense, an affine boundary over the manifold X. And we've got the action of the structural group, abstractly, as Poincaré transformations, but there is no action of the diffeomorphism of the base, actually, on the fibres. So we've got to tie together the action of diffeomorphism on the base and on the fibres. So what we want to consider now is how it can be the case that if I make an infinitesimal diffeomorphism generated by a vector field, that is going to be in some sense equivalent to a covariant derivative. But it's a general statement that the lead derivative under some vector field of A is the covariant derivative, the product of the vector with the one form, minus the inner product with V with the curvature. And now what we do is we take this general equation, which is true in the entire algebra, and project onto the translation ideal. Project onto the translations themselves. Project onto the translation ideal. And what we find is that the lead derivative of VA is D of the algebra element, which in general will have two components, epsilon A, UAB, minus the inner product of V with the torsion tensor, or the torsion one form. Now, we would like this to be an infinitesimal gauge transformation, it is, equaling lead derivative. And what we need, therefore, is to find out what epsilon is such that this can be true. And that can be true if nu AB is essentially omega AB nu V nu. In other words, it's the inner product of V with this one form. And epsilon A is EA nu mu, and moreover, the torsion is equal to zero. And so, we think of this as a constraint which we impose on the previously unconstrained entities omega and e, such as to tie together diffeomorphisms on the base, general coordinate transformations, and gauge transformations. So this is in supergravity called a torsion constraint. And if we have a Lagrangian, which is our ultimate aim, constructed from, for example, omega and E, then there are essentially two ways in which we can handle this constraint. And they give rise to two sorts of formalisms in the theory. The first way is to impose this before we vary the action. In other words, we can regard the action, say, as a function of omega. We can regard omega as a function of E. And that is called the second order formalism. It's the analogue of regarding the Einstein action as a function of the metric only. But we could, in fact, Instead of solving for the constraint and substituting into the action, we can do something different. And a priori, they might not seem to be the same. In practice, for the Einstein action, they are the same, which is to try to derive this constraint as an Euler-Lagrange equation. In that formalism, we would have a Lagrangian, which depends independently on omega and on E. And when we make the variations with respect to omega, we will get an equation which tells us that the torsion vanishes. And then when we make the variations with respect to E, we find that we get an equation which tells us that the Ricci curvature, or the Einstein tensor of the corresponding metric, vanishes. So let me write that down. Which one here? Okay, so an infinitesimal gauge transformation is generated by an element of the Lie algebra valued function. But in this matrix representation, this is a Lie algebra valued function, which has a component epsilon and a component nu. Okay? And the definition of these is that they are the contractions of the relevant one form with V.
I think you mean A.
This is epsilon.
Left hand side.
Well, I want to project this equation only onto the translation. I'll project it. Sorry. Yeah. I beg your pardon. Is it clear what the equation means now for everybody? Beg your pardon. Okay. Well, that's an open constraint. It's not something you impose in the Euler-Lagrange equation. I agree with you. Yeah. Now, actually, I wouldn't want G to be positive definite, but I know what you mean, the Lorentz signature. But that's not a constraint in the sense that it's constraining the field model. It's a slightly different. It's a limitation on the space of fields, effectively, one wishes to consider.
In this first sort of form, there's no problem in the
metric. Indeed, yeah. Let me just write. Can I proceed just for a little while? That will become very transparent. I agree with that statement. Yeah, what you say is absolutely right. And the same ambiguities run through all of supergravity. I mean, they're inherent in this formulation. That I agree with. Okay. Well, I mean, specifically, there is an action, the Einstein action, for which this procedure works. This procedure goes back to Palatini in the early days of the subject, but its description in terms of this gauging is really a construct of the 1960s, people like Kibble and others writing out this formalism explicitly. Then it arose at that time because of the enthusiasm for what was called the gauge principle. As Greg Moore said, it really is it transcends ordinary relativity because it could allow more general configurations. So, there's an action principle, and there are two forms, first order of the second order. So the independent variables in this case are omega and E, and here they're E, and we've imposed this constraint T A equals 0, which allows us to solve in a standard way for omega as a function of E. And well, the actual thing that you need, well, if you were writing it out in terms of a metric, you'd write something like this. We'll write it out slightly differently later. There is a boundary term, but I'm ignoring the boundary term. This is just the scalar curvature. But for these purposes, this is usually rewritten up to a factor, which I'm embarrassed to say I couldn't figure out last night. In a differential form notation, bar AB is as before, and eta AB is the dual of the, I guess I can put the ABs upstairs. Now, in the variations, we use the fact that the variation of the curvature is some sort of covariant derivative in the usual way of a variation of the connection, and now we have the two formulations. So, in the one formulation, we regard this as a function independently of omega, and this involves E. Using this formula and integrating by parts, you find that you get the torsion constraint coming out. I won't write that out in detail. If, on the other hand, you use second order formalism, you'd think of that as a function of E. And then there are two contributions to the variation. One is the variation of this, which, when you work out the contractions, gives you the Einstein equations. And the second would be the variation in here. But that turns out to be a total derivative by the same formula. And so you get the same equations. Well, these are one form, so this is a two form. As just the ordinary star with respect to the Lorentz metric.
What?
Yeah. I mean, if you write it out, it turns out into a nightmare of epsilon symbols. But, I mean, there are.
I think of R as a function of omega, but where is the metric? You've given the metric at that time.
Well, R's definition, as always, is d omega is omega wedge omega.
Yeah.
I don't need the metric here.
Then what is the star when you take out the metric?
Well, I'm thinking these are orthonormal frames.
But then you need a metric in order to define a concept.
Yeah, a local tangent space metric, that's what you mean.
Now, what, if I understand correctly, you can think of a curvature as a function of a connection without a metric. That's what you said at the first point you did. From that point of view, of course, we don't have
the
metric yet.
Well, the metric here is a derived concept. The physical metric is given by the wrote down. Just this constant matrix times EA where EGB, right? So these are just numbers. And with respect to this orthonormal frame, I can take joules. Okay? So, in particular, EA wedge EB star is 1/2 epsilon AB MN EM EN. Well, that's just a bunch of numbers.
But you're assuming that the metric on space-time is quite far from the metric
Well, given the numbers, I get the metric. In other words, I'm assuming that it's an orthonormal frame, effectively, yes. I mean, I regard as the independent variables, well, that's what people do, the frames. Given the frames, I get the metric. But the equations just determine the frames. Well, it does. It is the star with respect to the G, which is defined using this formula. Okay?
But when you think of curvature as a function of omega as a function of connection, first you did not know the connection is torsion free. Only after you have proved it's torsion free, you know it comes from it. I mean, if that's the point of view, you can think of curvature as a function of metric or as a function of connection. When you think of curvature as a function of connection, of course, you are not assuming the connection comes from it. Then you prove the connection.
Well, we define the curvature as usual in terms of the connection.
At this stage, you don't have to assume the connection is from, right?
No, exactly. I define that by that.
Right, now, what is then the star?
Okay, so firstly, I now need to lower an index. So I lower an index, if you like, with what's called the metric on the tangent space.
Then you need a metric model.
Yes, that's correct.
So what is that?
But it's just a constant metric.
There's no constant metric.
Maybe it becomes it's a metric on the group. If you have a Lorentz group, that's how,
yeah,
you know,
that's on
the line. And there's a metric on the group, and there's a volume on the group. Just that metric that's very useful.
Yes.
Right. You could have meant by star EA EB, taking the star with respect to the metric, not say star, thinking it's over as one form. But you've actually written out the definition using the metric on the tangent.
Right.
So that results in
right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, well, that's more or less what I wanted to say about Einstein gravity for the time being. Let me turn now to, let me turn to the supercase. Okay. So the idea is to essentially follow the same path, but looking at the superpointer A group. So I need some facts about spinners. So let's consider to begin with some superpointer A. Four-dimensional case. Well, then it's a convenient fact that the Clifford algebra, which I'll specify more carefully shortly, is all of 4x4 real matrices, and I'm using conventions such that 0 squared is minus 1, and 1 squared is plus 1, etc. And now there's an underlying vector space here, a real vector space, which looks like R4, and that's the space of Majorana spinners. Let's call it S. Now, S carries a symplectic form. C, which is a 4x4 matrix, which is odd. And that's usually called the charge conjugation matrix. There's some difference in terminology in the physics literature about what the charge conjugation matrix is, because it can be compared with gamma zero, but that's what it will be. It has the property that C gamma A C to the minus 1 is minus gamma A transposed, if you write. Okay, so this means that S and S star may be identified, and the conventional terminology is that if psi is an element of S, the corresponding element in S star is written as psi bar, and psi bar 1, for example, psi 2 is the same as C of psi 1, psi 2, or an index notation. Psi bar A is psi B, C, B, A, where elements of S have actually got an index A. Now, at this stage, you're going to swear because this is a different letter, so I'll call it mu. So that was, should be familiar from Henry's talk. For later purposes, it's true, as he points out, that in a similar statement is true in 11 dimensions. Algebra of 10-1 defined in the same way, and that is the same as R32. So we have 32 components, real Majorana spinners, and they're also it's a symplectic form. And of course, by virtue of the identity, 32 is 4 times 8. If we do a dimensional reduction, if we decompose, then we get, I won't write this out in detail, we get 8 supersymmetries. In 4 dimensions. In other words, decomposition gives you 8 Majorana fermions. Okay, now, the idea is to consider the supergroup, and in the notation that I've been using, that just means they're enlarging the matrix. So Poincaré acts on Minkowski space, super Poincaré acts on superspace. Does so. Well, what is superspace? It's just an x and a theta, so the sum of the spaces. Now if we put a 1, we send that to, well now that's lambda of s, let's not call that s, let's call that sigma, epsilon bar gamma mu, 2, a mu, 0, oh there's an s here, sigma rather. There's a sigma, an epsilon, a 0, 0, and 1. Now sigma, so this matrix that I put the indices on will be, that it acts on x mu theta. Add 1. I think that's all right. Sigma is in spin 3-1, and lambda is just the image under the 2-1 homomorphism, so the Rand transformation corresponds to it. Now, to see what's going on here, let's consider a simple case. Okay, so let's. So this is. We've extended the space. So this is the old piece and this piece. And now we put this and this and this together.
Why is there sigma in the row 1
column 2? So the thing combines in the right way. If you work out the, if you compose the matrices, you'll see that this has to work. Now, if we put S to be the identity, then X goes to X is a half epsilon gamma ray theta. I'm sorry, sigma. The reason I'm changing, I think about it. I've got S in my notes, but of course I've got S in space in my spinner. So. And theta goes to theta plus epsilon. So these are the basic transformations on superspace, and then the rest is made consistent with the Poincaré group. So, as I said before, x and theta corresponds to superspace. And you can think of a superspace as a super Poincaré over Lorentz. In fact, it's an invariant subgroup. Now, again, think of the theta as anticommutative. Now, we can look at the corresponding the superalgebra. And we can work out curvatures. So I'm usually right. F is a half. Linear, linear, plus Q bar rho, so. And some computations related to RAB, linear. Something stupid here. What should it be? What am I done? Excuse me. That's fine. I'm sorry. I should have written down A. Which is only immune here. Sidebar. Gamma mu over 2, e mu, 0, a fourth, omega mu, gamma mu, psi, 0, 0, 0. So we're introducing a spinner valued one form now, associated to the super translation. Psi is a spinner valued one form, which is called the rotor Schwinger field. And we can compute these curvatures, so what we get so this thing is conceived of as a vector valued two form, but with values in the odd part, sorry, even part of the algebra, but in order 2. And rho, the corresponding curvature, is d psi plus, of course, there we go, mu, nu, gamma mu. Gamma mu times psi. So we see that the torsion here receives a contribution from the fermionic sector. Now it turns out that the correct constraints are again that this torsion is equal to 0, which implies, of course, that the torsion of this is not 0, it's got a fermionic contribution. And so that gives you a fermionic contribution to. Yeah, fermionic contribution to torsion. In actual fact, this is not so surprising. I'll come back to the answer that question in a moment. This is not so surprising, in fact. If you take the formalism that we started with, this Einstein action expressed in terms of the frames, and you add in any matter fields whatsoever, when you do a variation, the matter fields will contain omega. And so, in fact, the torsion won't vanish. It will be give you a contribution from what is the spin current of the matter field. So, in general, there will always be some equation of the torsion of the frames, if you like, is equal to some spin density. In other words, a vector valued two-form which corresponds to a spin current. So that's a generic feature you would have expected. Of course, what you don't expect, or what you wouldn't have anticipated, is the precise formula. Okay, well, now the statement is, and I hope to indicate in more detail how this comes out next time, is as follows. For simple supergravity in four dimensions, if you adjoin to the Lagrangian that we've just used, the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian, an appropriate action for the spin three-halves field, which will be expressed also in terms of spin connections, and do the variations, now you will have variations with respect to psi, which is the gauge field for supersymmetry. You will do the variations with respect to E and omega. And again, you have the possibility of doing a first or a second order formulation. If you do the first order formulation, you derive the fact that the torsion vanishes. If you do the second order variation, impose this as a condition, then you may derive the fact that the action is invariant under supersymmetry transformations. So I'll try to explain that in more detail in the next lecture.
Suggestion that came up after yesterday's session was that it might go smoother if questions were submitted in advance in writing. So I invite you to do that, and you can even put them in my mailbox. I make no promise to answer them, of course. And you can do it, you know, when you write it or back to the moment when you submitted the question. So feel free to ask it out. Goodbye. Talk to you later.